previously on Red Pilled America.
The sole reason they give for their intention to fire me is my membership in the Communist Party.
That this entire incident, starting with the hiring of Miss Davis, was a deliberate provocation.
Political opinions should be brought into the classroom. They belong in the classroom.
A court decision last week declared the regent's action unconstitutional.
Don't minimize the university as your base.
We have to talk about a complete and total change in the structures of this society.
Four students lay dead on the campus grounds.
We build the schools that they want to burn down.
I suppose I just lost that job at UCLA.
Where did wokeness come from? I'm Patrick Carelci.
And I'm Adriana Cortez.
And this is Red Pilled America, a storytelling show.
This is not another talk show covering the day's news. We are all about telling stories.
Stories Hollywood doesn't want you to hear.
Stories the media mocks. Stories about everyday Americans that the globalists ignore.
You could think of Red Pilled America as audio documentaries, and we promise only one thing. The truth.
Welcome to Red Pilled America.
We're at the final part of our series of episodes entitled Woke Army. You've probably heard the first four, but if you haven't, stop and go back and listen from the beginning. We're looking for the answer to the question, where did wokeness come from? By telling the story of how an obscure group of German refugees started all of this woke madness and what we need to do to stop it.
So in our last episode, we told the story of how Angela Davis and other revolutionaries escalated their Marxist struggle on the streets and college campuses of America. California Governor Ronald Reagan was working to help keep radicals and militants out of the state's college campuses. He forced Herbert Marcuse into retirement at UCSD and blocked the Black Panthers from officially speaking on college campuses. In defiance, UCLA hired the one person that represented both Black militants and radical academics, Angela Davis. The UC Regents, who govern the University of California, voted to fire her, citing its longtime policy of not hiring communists. Angela's childhood friend, Bettina Apotheker, helped the radical professor rally the troops at UCLA, and Angela joined a faculty group in a lawsuit against the UC Regents. Ultimately, a Superior Court judge ruled that the firing was unconstitutional, and Angela was reinstated. She boldly announced that she'd be bringing her brand of Marxist politics into the classroom. Then she joined her teacher, Herbert Marcuse, in a victory lap at the birthplace of student insurrection, UC Berkeley. The two laid out a long-term plan to ignite a socialist revolution. The new oppressed groups identified by Marcuse had to bring the fight to the streets and, more importantly, to the campuses. They saw the university as the base of their socialist revolution because it taught the next generation of leaders.
A few weeks later, the Black Panthers' Los Angeles headquarters was raided by the LAPD, and after a five-hour gun battle, the Panthers threw up the white flag. Angela felt that their socialist revolution was right around the corner, and she called on revolutionaries to take up arms to help usher it in. The energy was building. The radicals just needed a new trigger to enlist the moderate left to their cause. That would come in late April 1970, when Nixon expanded the Vietnam War into Cambodia. Almost on cue, radicals organized a national student strike. Over 1 million students protested on nearly 900 college campuses. When the dust settled, students lay dead at Kent State and Jackson State universities, and 30 ROTC buildings were burned to the ground. Moderate anti-war students didn't realize it, but they just participated in a socialist insurrection. The country had had enough. A counter-protest took to the streets opposing the student violence. The FBI was in the midst of an effort to break up organizations like the Black Panthers and Students for a Democratic Society, or SDS. Nixon began an investigation into the source of the campus unrest, and the UC Regents made moves to terminate Angela Davis once and for all from her UCLA teaching post. But Angela wanted to keep up the heat. She began championing a new cause, the freedom of the Soledad brothers, three convicts charged with murdering a prison guard. She'd taken a liking to one in particular, George Jackson, one of the Soledad brothers imprisoned 9 years earlier for armed robbery. George Jackson captured Angela Davis's heart, and the Frankfurt School disciple began working with the convict's young Black Panther brother, Jonathan Jackson, to rally the country around his release. But then, in the summer of 1970, the effort to free George Jackson took a dark turn.
On a hot summer day in August 1970, a trial was in session in a Marin County courthouse in Northern California. A Black convict named James McLean was being tried for the stabbing of a prison guard. The trial was presided over by Superior Court Judge Harold Haley, a 65-year-old, thin-haired white man with dark-rimmed glasses. Judge Haley was a pillar of the community. He'd married his high school sweetheart. They had three daughters together. Life was good. But something was about to change all of that. As the trial was in session, a young, tall Black man with an afro entered the courtroom. He brought with him a bag, and strangely, he was wearing a trench coat. Given the time of year and the hot weather, it was an odd choice of fashion. As he sat down, he caught the eye of a bailiff, who remembered seeing him the day before in the courtroom, wearing the same jacket. As a suspicious young character surveyed the room, the prosecutor was questioning a defense witness in the case, another Black convict named Rochelle McGee. Moments later, all hell broke loose. The trench-coated man stood up and yelled out. A witness described what he said.
Hit the floor, and looking to the spectator side of the courtroom, saw a tall, light-complected Negro with bushy hair pointing a handgun at the back of the neck of Lieutenant Dixon of San Quentin Correctional Force.
The intruder was Jonathan Jackson, the Black Panther colleague of Angela Davis, and the younger brother of George Jackson, one of the primary Soledad brothers. As everyone hit the floor, the man that was on trial asked Jonathan if he brought the tape. Jonathan gave it to him along with the shotgun, and McLean taped the shotgun to Judge Haley's neck, placing the barrel right below his chin. He told the judge, "If I die, you're dying too." While this was happening, Jonathan gave handguns to the other Black convicts, Rochelle McGee and William Christmas. Both were witnesses in the trial and friends with the defendant. Jonathan Jackson then pulled out a shotgun and an M1 carbine with a banana clip. The three convicts and Jonathan now had complete control of the courtroom. They had the judge call the sheriff's office, and McLean took the phone and made a demand.
"We want the Soledad brothers free, or we'll kill Judge Haley."
The hoodlums next grabbed several hostages. Adding to Judge Haley, they took three white female jurors as well as the prosecutor. They cautiously began making their way out of the courthouse, disarming guards along the way. That's when they crossed the path of a photographer for a local paper.
"Well, I was coming in from an assignment, just a regular, normal assignment, and picked up on the police monitor a call from the Civic Center that there was an armed gunman in the corridor. So I rolled to the Civic Center, went up to the court floor, got off the elevator, and I went around a corner and I encountered a man with two guns, and I was then part of the action."
But the photographer was not taken hostage. He'd soon learn why.
"They wanted the publicity. They invited me to take pictures. And I was convinced at that time that this was similar to a Cuban hijack, that there was a purpose behind it. And one of the men, as they left in the elevator, after they told me that they didn't want me as a hostage, did say, 'We want the Soledad brothers freed by 12:30 today.'"
Jonathan Jackson, the three escapees, and their hostages made their way to a van in the parking lot. The photographer could see them from his vantage point.
"They all got into the truck after a little bit of confusion about who was going to drive.
Once they were all in, Judge Haley asked where they were going. McLean reportedly answered,
'We'd go into the airport and take a plane.'
As Jonathan began to drive, he put his hand outside the window of the van. In it, he was holding a revolver. Then suddenly, he came to a stop. That's when a flurry of shots were fired. Jonathan pulled his hand back in the car and it was bleeding. The prosecutor looked over to the judge and saw one of the convicts, Rochelle McGee, with the sawed-off shotgun beneath the judge's chin. A moment later, McGee pulled the trigger, blowing off the judge's face. Now in a fight for his life, the prosecutor wrestled a gun from Jonathan Jackson, shot him with it, then shot in the area of two of the convicts. A few seconds later, the gun flurry ended. The third convict, William Christmas, was outside on the pavement, laying lifeless. That's when the photographer arrived at the scene.
And even then, and as quickly as it was happening, you could see that the back window was blown out. There were many bullet holes in the truck that were visible from the outside. The doors opened, and the hostages bolted out. And we looked in, and we could see the dead convicts and the dead judge.
The prosecutor was slumped over in the van. He was shot in the spine by a bullet from outside, paralyzing him from the waist down. The shocking event was sensational, even by California standards.
How did it happen that Superior Court Judge Harold Haley and three others were killed?
The youth who brought guns into Judge Haley's courtroom was Jonathan Jackson, brother of one of the Soledad three. Jonathan had yelled in the courtroom corridor to free the Soledad brothers before he made his escape and was killed.
Investigators for the Marin County Sheriff's Department still are not sure of all the details, but they are piecing together the story from witnesses and participants in the shocking crime that took place here yesterday.
At this point, as near as we can determine, one of the witnesses in the van said they heard a shot. Immediately, the judge's head was blown off. The assistant district attorney then grappled with the inmates, procured a gun, and shot three of them. During this interim, there was other gunfire going on.
There are still a great many loose ends and a great deal of speculation about what happened here. Investigators will now try to determine if there was a conspiracy of some kind that involved, perhaps, more persons than those who actually participated in the bloody event. Investigators say militant organizations such as the Black Panther Party will be high on the list of inquiry.
Welcome back to Red Pilled America. So after a courthouse escape attempt and a demand to set the Soledad brothers free, four people laid dead, including Black Panther Jonathan Jackson and Judge Haley. The investigation started immediately. They searched a satchel they found in the van. There were books in it. One was titled The Politics of Violence in the Modern World. On the inside cover was the name Angela Y. Davis. Another book was titled Violence and Social Change. It too had the name Angela Y. Davis on the inside cover. They swept the contents of the satchel for prints and found Angela Davis's print on a book and on two pamphlets. One of the pamphlets was associated with the M1 carbine used by Jonathan Jackson in the getaway attempt. An investigator checked Jonathan's wallet and found a yellow slip of paper. On it was a phone number. They tracked it to a public payphone near the American Airlines ticket counter at the San Francisco airport. They questioned workers there. A Pacific Southwest Airlines ticket agent said on the day of the shooting, just a few minutes before 2 p.m., Angela Davis came running up in a panic to the counter and bought a ticket to Los Angeles. She paid by check. The ticket agent said Angela had no luggage. They heard from another officer. He claimed he stopped Angela Davis and Jonathan Jackson at the Mexico border about a week prior to the shootout. Investigators spoke to a custodian, an officer, and a shuttle driver at the San Quentin prison. They placed Angela with Jonathan at the prison on August 4th and August 5th as he visited his brother George Jackson. The shootout happened on August 7th. A bailiff claimed he saw Jonathan in the courtroom the day before the shooting wearing the same trench coat. When Jonathan showed up, he learned that the trial had cut short that day, so he left. Could this have been a test run? Investigators dug further and found four separate witnesses that placed Angela with Jonathan at a gas station across the street from the Marin courthouse the day before the shootout. They also began tracking down the guns used in the escape attempt. And that's when things got even more interesting. One was purchased at a Western Surplus in Los Angeles by Angela Davis. 2 days before the shootout, a pair of employees from a San Francisco area pawn shop said Angela, accompanied by Jonathan, purchased a shotgun from their store. The clerks recognized Angela because of her distinct look, and they even asked her for an autograph. The shotgun turned out to be the one that blew off Judge Haley's head. In fact, every one of the private guns used in the failed escape attempt were purchased by Angela Davis. the stunning news began making its way to the media.
Turned out that two of the guns used in the courtroom were bought by Angela Davis. She was the teacher fired from the University of California at Los Angeles.
Angela Davis is now reported to be in Toronto, Canada. It is not certain why she went there, if indeed she did, or when, although friends claim it was about 2 weeks ago. She has not been charged with anything, although rumors do persist that conspiracy to commit murder is being considered. If that is the case, then presumably police would have to be prepared to prove that she gave those guns to a minor with the intent of using them in the escape attempt.
A state official spoke to reporters about discovering who bought the guns.
What was she doing with those guns?
I haven't the foggiest idea what she was doing with the guns at that time. Obviously, since that time, the guns have had rather an interesting way throughout the state of California, finally winding up in Marin County. And from our information, the guns that were used in the killing of the people in Marin County.
Do you think it's true communist revolutionary style for her to have bought these guns in her own name?
That'd be difficult to say. There's nothing to be said that a communist has to be smart.
Investigators felt they had enough to get an arrest warrant for the Marxist academic.
As this was in motion, a funeral service was held for Judge Haley.
Judge Haley, for whom Mass was said here today, died in one of the most bizarre escape attempts ever staged. Nearly 100 law enforcement officers joined perhaps 1,000 Marinites at St. Sylvester Catholic Church for the Mass. The sheriff's office now believes from witnesses that there were shots fired from the escape van before the judge was killed.
On the other side of town in Oakland, the Black Panthers held a funeral for Jonathan Jackson.
The convicts who died earned themselves a hero's funeral and a guard of honor from the Black Panthers.
Astonishingly, thousands of white, black, and brown people lined the streets, holding their fists in the air to salute the young man responsible for the whole bloody affair. Practically pulled from the pages of Herbert Marcuse's Repressive Tolerance, they were not only accepting but celebrating the despicable actions coming from the radical left, including the killing of an innocent judge.
Even as the convicts were being buried, the police were busily tracing the guns which had been used in the shootout, and they'd all been registered in the name of Angela Davis. On the strength of this, a warrant was issued for her arrest, and her name was put on the FBI list of the nation's most wanted criminals.
Bettina Apotheker, Angela Davis's childhood friend that helped organize the 1964 UC Berkeley student protest, attended the funeral with her husband. A black militant friend of Angela's walked up to Bettina and, without looking in her eyes, said loud enough for Bettina to hear that Angela had been implicated in the killings and that she'd gone underground. Angela Davis was on the run. She thought about leaving the country, maybe Cuba or Canada, but knew that if she left, she'd never be able to come back. So, Angela made her way to a friend in Chicago, a guy named David Poindexter. She hid in his apartment, but Poindexter got in a fight with a neighbor, and they were afraid that the neighbor would rat them out if the FBI came knocking. So they fled to Miami. Meanwhile, the FBI got a tip that Angela was in Chicago. They went to the Windy City and leaned on Poindexter's ex-girlfriend. They learned that Angela had been in the area, but fled with Poindexter to his mother's hometown of Florida. The FBI also got the make of the car they were driving. They were closing in on them. After the FBI questioned Poindexter's mom, Angela knew she had to get out of Florida as well. While the FBI was hunting for her in Miami, Angela and her companion took off to the Big Apple. But it wasn't long before the FBI got a call. Law enforcement found Angela's vehicle parked at an NYC Howard Johnson. On October 13, 1970, agents descended on the motel and nabbed Angela as she was en route to her room.
Black revolutionary Angela Davis appeared without her distinctive Afro hairdo as she was arraigned in New York City today as a fugitive from justice.
President Nixon spoke to the Justice Department about the arrest.
I think that the actions of the FBI in apprehending Angela Davis, a rather remarkable story again, in the long history of remarkable stories of apprehensions by the FBI, is an indication that once the federal government, through the FBI, moves into an area, we shall see to it that those who engage in such terroristic acts are brought to justice.
Angela's comrade, Bettina Apotheker, immediately flew to NYC to begin working on a campaign to get her free. Angela was desperately trying to avoid being extradited to California. And why?
The big question after the arrest was whether Miss Davis would be extradited from New York to stand trial in California, an issue of more than academic importance, because under Californian law, any person aiding and abetting the commission of a crime becomes as guilty as those who actually carry it out. This meant that Miss Davis would face a possible death penalty if found guilty in California. It was a prospect she fought strenuously against in the New York courts, supported by vociferous crowds of demonstrators on the streets outside. But all the shouting and marching didn't influence the courts, and Miss Davis was duly sent back to San Rafael to stand trial with Russell McGee.
On arrival in California, Bettina and Angela started brainstorming on a public campaign to get her free. They first needed to start raising money for her defense. The Communist Party was there to answer the call.
A nationwide Free Angela Davis movement was rapidly organized among America's radicals with branch committees in 50 cities. For the moribund Communist Party, the whole affair is a much-needed shot in the arm. Angela Davis has become their first martyr for years, and the party is now trying to raise $50,000 for her defense.
Her team of lawyers and supporters went to work as well. They began crafting a narrative. Angela was being framed.
The attempts in the press to link her with a shooting in Marin 2 months ago is based solely on police informer allegations and has no basis in fact. The pillory of Angela Davis comes at a time when she, with others, was exposing in a mass way the condition of the prison system.
The more that I see of the state of California, the more doubtful I become whether or not there is any fairness. The more I become impressed by Mr. McGee's position that it's a conspiracy, a statewide conspiracy, perhaps a nationwide conspiracy, to murder him and Miss Davis. I don't know the names of the conspirators. I don't know the particular dates that they met and agreed. I don't know exactly what their ultimate purpose is, except that as it affects my client immediately, I fear that they're trying to take her life.
It was really a preposterous position. It was indisputable that the guns were purchased by Angela Davis, yet her lawyers and spokesmen continued to argue that she was being framed. What did they expect law enforcement to do? Disregard the fact that Angela's guns were used to kill a judge? She must have understood the optics of her situation because Angela took to the media from behind bars to deal with the issue of the guns.
People get very upset when they hear that black people have weapons, or own weapons. I grew up in Birmingham, Alabama. Some very, very good friends of mine were killed by bombs, bombs that were planted by racists. I remember from the time I was very small, I remember the sounds of bombs exploding across the street, our house shaking. I remember my father having to have guns at his disposal at all times because of the fact that at any moment someone, we might expect to be attacked.
But she wasn't carrying guns for her protection at all times, because if she was, they would have been in her possession and not used in the murder of a judge. Angela appeared to be using a victim argument as a deflection. Her owning guns wasn't the question. What was under scrutiny was that her guns were used to murder a judge, and all in an attempt to free a convict that she'd been working to set free. The connection seemed obvious. When preliminary hearings took place in Angela's trial, she began to do something shocking to most law and order-loving citizens. She embraced Rochelle McGee, the convict involved in the murder of Judge Haley.
At least on the surface, the federal courtroom was different. There were no uniformed guards. Rochelle McGee was not chained to his chair as he is in Marin County. And he and Angela Davis were allowed to sit next to each other and even embraced on being brought into the courtroom.
Miss Davis, who was participating in her own defense thus far, cried out during the hearing, "Free Rochelle McGee."
The move was either sincere or tactical. Either way, by supporting the black convict involved in murdering a judge, she showed the radicals on the street and college campuses that she was one of them, to the very end. Well, it appeared to be working. Radical academics began speaking out in her defense.
Well, the way I feel about Angela right now is the way I think all black people have felt
throughout history when they've seen their sisters and mothers being taken off and raped.
What they're doing to her is an exaggerated form of what happens every day to black people in this country.
You have Angela Davis and you have Michelle McGee, her co-defendant in this case. Both of them are political prisoners.
Some people represent the struggle physically and others represent it vocally. Angela Davis is a spokeswoman for the struggle. Beyond everything, she's still my sister and I want her to survive.
Angela and Bettina Apotheker also came up with another brilliant plan. 2 days before the murder of Judge Haley, Black Panther co-founder Huey P. Newton was acquitted for murdering a police officer. A coalition of white and black militants successfully applied public pressure, leading to the release of the Black Panther. Angela wanted to do the same. So, her and Bettina worked on editing a book that could be used as a political weapon to organize communist support from both in and outside of America to demand her freedom. They released the book in 1971, and the Marxist left from all around the world began to demand the release of the so-called political prisoner Angela Davis.
In America, supporters of the Black Liberation Movements are stepping up the pressure in the campaign to free Angela Davis, the black philosophy lecturer and communist who is now facing a charge of murder in California.
Free Angela Davis! Right now! Free Angela! Right now!
The American left is incensed over the case, but interest in it has not been confined to the United States. Overseas, the response to the Angela Davis case has been almost as strong as in America. Over 2,000 West Germans gathered to demand freedom for the black militant teacher, and left-wing groups all over Europe have staged similar protests. From Russia, a group of scientists has written to President Nixon, asking him to ensure that the case is judged with full impartiality and humanity. At the center of this storm is a slim, attractive black girl who at 27 has already established an impressive academic record. The philosopher Herbert Marcuse called her his best pupil in 30 years.
The Free Angela media campaign reached such global proportions that it attracted the type of people that loved a virtue signal, celebrities. Jane Fonda, Leonard Bernstein, and Sammy Davis Jr. spoke out in her defense. Yoko Ono and John Lennon released an Angela Davis tribute song. Aretha Franklin even offered to pony up bail money. Problem with that was, Angela was facing the death penalty. Given her record, the judge thought her possible death sentence meant she was a flight risk, so he refused bail. But then something remarkable happened.
Official word came from the Supreme Court clerk's office at noon when the actual decision was passed out to reporters. By a 6-1 vote, the court ordered life imprisonment for convicted murderer Robert Anderson and made its ruling applicable to all persons now sentenced to die.
The California Supreme Court ruled the death penalty unconstitutional.
The court said that capital punishment degrades and dehumanizes all who participate in its processes and is unnecessary to any legitimate goal of the state and incompatible with the dignity of man and the judicial process.
The ruling meant that Angela Davis was now eligible for bail, and in February 1972, they found the bail money from an unexpected source.
Her attorney, Howard Moore, said that the man who put up the $100,000 for the surety bond was Roger McPhee of Fresno County, a cooperative farmer. Angela Davis and her supporters were, of course, ecstatic at her release from jail.
After release, Angela went to Bettina Apotheker's house to celebrate.
I feel fine. I feel better than I have in 16 months. The real reason why I feel better is because now I'm able to give much more of myself to the struggle to free all of our sisters and brothers.
Right on, Angela.
The trial began a month later in March 1970. Herbert Marcuse and Bettina Apotheker could be seen attending as moral and tactical support. One big surprise was that Angela was added to the defense team as co-counsel. This was a stroke of genius. It allowed her to make the opening argument without having to be cross-examined. In her opening statement, she admitted to having purchased all of the guns but denied giving them to Jonathan Jackson. She challenged the prosecution to provide any evidence that proved that she had any knowledge or intent of the escape attempt. Angela argued that when she heard the police were looking for her, she didn't run, she just made herself unavailable. Angela claimed she feared for her life at the hands of the cops. She was being targeted for her work in trying to free the Soledad brothers. It was just that simple.
The prosecution made the same arguments that they'd made at the time of her indictment.
Angela Davis is accused not of carrying out the crime, but of supplying guns to those such as Rushell McGee, who allegedly did so. McGee was one of two convicts appearing in the trial when the kidnapping took place.
There weren't many surprises during the prosecution's case. They laid out the circumstantial evidence, the guns, that her near-constant companion leading up to the shootout was Jonathan Jackson, the fact that she fled, the witness testimony to Jonathan and her being together, and so on. But the prosecution did include evidence that came in late to the case. You may recall that the motive for the Marin County Courthouse shootout was to free the Soledad brothers, and in particular, Jonathan Jackson's older brother, George. Angela had been working to free him in the months leading up to the shootout. From jail, Angela spoke about how she first met him.
First time I met him was on the occasion of one of the court appearances in Salinas, California. I had not really expected the scene that confronted me when I walked into that courtroom and sat down and saw coming into the courtroom three black men who were chained and shackled. I had never seen black men before with chains all over their bodies. It was certainly reminiscent of slavery. And in spite of the fact that they were completely suppressed in a physical sense, you could see from the attitude and their demeanor when they entered the courtroom that they were not for a moment going to resign themselves to that situation, that they were, that they had a very profound fighting spirit, and it was that which really affected me very strongly.
When Angela became imprisoned as well, she began to write to George. In one instance, in July 1971, Angela and George were astonishingly allowed to meet in a holding cell outside of a Marin Civic Center courtroom while they were both still incarcerated. It was reportedly the first time they'd spend time together in the same room for a long stretch of time. They were intimate. Immediately after their meeting, Angela began writing George love letters. Over a period of a month, the letters were smuggled out of Angela's detention center and delivered to George Jackson at San Quentin. He kept them hidden in his cell. But in August 1971, George attempted an escape from prison and was killed in the process. When his cell was searched, Angela's letters were found. The prosecution made them the centerpiece of Angela's motive.
Prosecutor Albert Harris wound up his case by trying to establish Miss Davis's love for Soledad brother George Jackson as the motive for her alleged participation in the escape plot. Just before he rested, he read to the jury edited portions of an 18-page diary or letter written to Jackson 11 months after the shootout. "I am totally intoxicated, overflowing with you," the letter said. "That so much love could exist anywhere, I never realized." The next day, Harris said, she wrote, "I'm crazy with love and desire, and I guess you're already willing to accept all the consequences." Miss Davis and her attorneys had fought hard to keep the diary from being entered as evidence.
In another letter, she wrote about their first meeting in May 1970, saying, quote, "As I was pulling myself together after the court appearance in Salinas, I was struck by a similar sense of inexorably succumbing to you, just you, being absorbed by that huge, beautiful man with whom I had instantly and unexpectedly fallen in love," end quote. In another passage, she wrote, quote, love you with love even more unbounded, even more unconquerable, your lifelong wife," end quote. After 9 weeks and over 100 witnesses, the prosecution rested its case. Now it was the defense's turn.
"The defense will attack that series of events as coincidental and not proving anything other than Miss Davis's concern for her own safety and her involvement in militant leftist political causes. They scoff at the allegations of love for Jackson being a motive in a conspiracy to free him. Her attorney, Howard Moore, admits she bought the guns and that young Jonathan Jackson had access to them. Both Moore and Miss Davis deny she planned with Jackson for the escape. They say she left the state because she knew
She was to be persecuted for her political activism and her closeness to the Jacksons.
Angela Davis never testified. Her team largely took a standard approach to their defense. They focused on the circumstantial nature of the prosecution's case, trying at every turn to poke holes to prove a reasonable doubt. Her defense attorney challenged the witness's testimony, placing Angela with Jonathan Jackson on the days leading up to the shootout. It simply wasn't his client.
Defense attorney Leo Bratton said he did not know who the person was that the prosecution witnesses had identified as Angela Davis, but he said it wasn't his job to find out. Angela Davis is no fool, he continued. Why would she buy a gun to blow a judge's head off and buy it in her own name? The prosecution's theory is absurd. The jury will begin deliberating her guilt or innocence tomorrow.
After a 13-week trial, both sides rested. The jury went into deliberation. But just when people thought the case couldn't become more sensationalized, shocking news hit the airwaves.
Welcome back to Red Pilled America. So after 13 weeks, both sides in the Angela Davis trial rested. The jury went into deliberation. But just when people thought the case couldn't become more sensationalized, shocking news hit the airwaves.
I heard one of the stewardesses come running up to the other stewardess, and she said, "This is it, it's happening to us." And I asked her what was happening to us, and then I saw a man in an army uniform come up the aisle and go into the cockpit, and I knew we were being hijacked, and I started crying. I told my husband.
A militant faction of the Students for a Democratic Society, or SDS, hijacked a plane and demanded both money and that Angela Davis be let free.
The hijacker had announced over the intercom earlier, "SDS men relax, our demands are being met." And another message had included the word "weathermen," which is a radical offshoot of Students for a Democratic Society. After a refueling stop in New York, where the passengers were let off, the Western 720H took off again for Algeria with $500,000.
During yesterday's hijacking, in which it was thought Miss Davis had been demanded by the hijacker, the defendant was brought to the courtroom. She looked distraught and tired.
Angela's defense team claimed no knowledge of the hijacking. They wanted their fate to be handed by the jury, and that was no doubt a calculated decision. You see, Angela's lawyers applied a novel approach to jury selection. At the time in 1972, jury selection took a very unsophisticated approach. But for Angela's case, five black psychologists volunteered to help with the process to develop personality profiles for each prospective juror. They carefully watched them, whether they interacted with others, how they acted at lunch period, whether they were talkative. They slipped questions to Angela's lawyers to acquire the necessary data. Ultimately, they helped Angela's team select a group of jurors that would give her the best chance for an acquittal. It's been an approach to jury selection ever since, because it worked. After just 13 hours of deliberation, an all-white jury found Angela Davis innocent on all counts. On exiting the courtroom, one jurist looked at Angela's cheering supporters, smiled, and raised the black power fist to the crowd. In fact, the jury held Angela in such high regard that a majority of them joined in the celebration parties of her acquittal. At one of the gatherings, Angela rejoiced in the decision.
"It's really a wonderful feeling to be back among the people. To be back among all of you who fought so long and so hard. Among all of you who actually achieved my freedom. And I really wish you could have been there in the courtroom at the moment when those three not guilty verdicts were pronounced. Because that victory was just as much yours as it was mine."
By the end of the trial, America had changed. The public had not only grown tired of the violence, it welcomed government actions to decisively end it. Through a series of raids and prosecutions, the Black Panthers had been successfully disintegrated. The Black Power ringleader, Stokely Carmichael, not only left the organization, he left the country. The Students for a Democratic Society, or SDS, had also been fractured. When the organization effectively dissolved by the early 1970s, a militant faction of SDS, known as the Weathermen, went underground. In addition to hijacking a plane to try and free Angela Davis, the Weather Underground, as it came to be known, bombed the Pentagon, U.S. Capitol, a New York police station, and other locations. If there were any flames left to use violence for social change, the Weather Underground effectively smothered the embers. The group turned public opinion against the militant efforts. But what effectively ended this Marxist revolution was that the U.S. government got smart. It removed the fuel that was inciting moderates to work with the radicals. You may remember that after the violence and destruction caused by the 1970 National Student Strike, President Nixon organized a commission to study the cause of campus unrest. By the summer of 1970, hints on the conclusion of that work began to make its way out to the public. In an August 1970 interview, while Angela Davis was still on the run, Vice President Spiro Agnew spoke about a primary instigator of the campus unrest.
You have a very extreme professor, such as Marcuse, literally poisoning, a lot of young minds with what I would consider to be some of the most irresponsible drivel that I've ever read or heard.
The Campus Unrest Commission issued its findings in September 1970, and in it, they cited the radical professor Herbert Marcuse as a key figure in providing the intellectual rationale for the Marxist insurrection. They concluded that students were being drawn to these radical figures because of the Vietnam War. The head of the commission, William Scranton, highlighted this point in September 1970.
It is true that the amount of campus disruption and violence, certainly, was much less in the period when the war seemed to be going in the direction of terminating and people were beginning to come back to the United States, for example, late last fall and this last winter and early spring. And certainly it got much stronger after the Cambodian, we all know that, after the Cambodian invasion. So the less accentuation there is of American participation and the more return of men, the more helpful it is, of course.
The American government now understood that if they removed the incentive for moderates to march with the militant Marxists, the unrest would subside. By 1975, the Vietnam War was over. The Marxists no longer had the flashpoint to give their small minority outsized power on the streets and college campuses of America. People were tired of the violence, campus unrest, burning down of buildings, killings, and bombings. These Marxist revolutionaries had hit a roadblock with their radical activism. Their tried and true strategy of violence and inciting moderates on college campuses was not only no longer working, it wasn't going to work. So what these radicals and militants did was, they went back to college. Reflecting on the era when Herbert Marcuse wreaked havoc at UC San Diego, the former chancellor of the school inadvertently touched on the radical students' eventual playbook.
I wouldn't let the governor of California intrude on our independence and freedom of the faculty to operate this school as we saw fit, and I'll be damned if I'm going to let a group of students do it either. That is, we govern the University of California, we faculty, and if the students wish to join us, let them become faculty.
And that's exactly what the socialist revolutionaries did. Herbert Marcuse died in 1979, but his teachings would immediately take hold in one particular American institution. The Marxist radicals, educated by the ideas of the Frankfurt School, put all of their chips on academia. The universities had already warmed up to the ideas of the Frankfurt School. Places like UCSD, UC Berkeley, UCLA, Brandeis College, and Columbia, they were already infected with Marxist radicals. So after the tumultuous 1960s, Marxism flourished at these universities, in departments like the humanities and theoretical-based studies. Philosophy was infected. English departments were plagued as well. Women's studies would eventually become gender studies, and they touted the woke doctrine. African American studies and Chicano studies adopted wokeness as well. Critical legal studies built on the Frankfurt School's critical theory and would eventually develop critical race theory. The university began to openly accept the radical and militant Marxists into their teaching staffs, a place where they can turn students into a woke army.
After Angela Davis was fired from her UCLA job, Ronald Reagan said she'd never work in the UC system again. That prediction didn't age well. In 1991, UC Santa Cruz appointed her professor in the history of consciousness. She literally became a woke professor. 3 years later, she was appointed to the UC Presidential Chair in African American and Feminist Studies. She'd go on to lecture at colleges all over the world. And the universities opened their doors to other militants. Many of the SDS revolutionaries, even ones that planted bombs and were responsible for the deaths of Americans, were eventually accepted into professor positions. The co-founder of the Black Panthers, Bobby Seale, who'd been accused of murder, would go on to teach Afro-American studies at Temple University. Through academia, they'd eventually take over the media, pumping out students from journalism school infected with the woke ideology. They'd link with Marxist radicals in Hollywood that had survived the communist purge of the 1940s and 1950s and had quietly retaken Tinseltown in the 1970s. What the Frankfurt School identified as the mass cultural industries of Hollywood, music, and art would eventually fully adopt the woke ideology of the Marxist intellectuals. They'd be comrades with academia. Through storytelling, they would help shift pop culture towards wokeness and reinforce the winds of the Marxists in every cultural institution. When big tech arose, it became populated by college graduates who'd all been filtered through woke universities. Big tech was bound to accept cancel culture, an ideology invented by Herbert Marcuse himself. The Marxists had effectively taken over every institution that defines what it means to be American, and they did it methodically over decades.
Which leads us back to the question, where did wokeness come from? It came from Marxism. Wokeness is Marxism repackaged. Wokeness was developed by a small group of German intellectuals to spark a socialist revolution in the Western world. All of the insanity you've been experiencing in society, the cancel culture, social justice warriors, critical race theory, all of the new pronouns, political correctness, the purging on social media, the diversity, equity, and inclusion departments, biological men competing in women's sports, affirmative action, the constant claims of institutional racism, the grooming of kids, all of this wokeness that you are experiencing is nothing less than a Marxist revolution. When we opened this series, we heard how surprised Greg Gutfeld was on the spread of wokeness.
It is everywhere you look. I don't think I've seen anything spread so fast in my life.
But we know that wokeness did not spread quickly. It's been nearly a century in the making. You have to almost admire their level of dedication. Like grains of salt slowly being added to a cup of water, you don't see the salt until the water is completely saturated. Then, once that last grain is added, you suddenly see salt everywhere in the glass. The Frankfurt School launched in 1923. It would eventually repackage Marxism and identify the institutions that define the culture of Western civilization, those being academia and what they called the mass culture industries of film, radio, music, magazines, and books. They then made the long march through the institutions, slowly adding converts to their cause. When violence on the streets and campuses no longer worked, blocking them from saturating our culture with Marxism, the disciples of the Frankfurt School took a different route. The ideology flourished in academia and in Hollywood and in the media, slowly adding converts until that last grain of salt was added in 2020, when again a Marxist insurrection exploded in America, disguised as Black Lives Matter protests. But it's no secret now. America is experiencing a socialist revolution, and the only way to stop it is to take a cue from the Marxists themselves. We need to make the long march through the institutions and purge wokeness with the truth. We have no other choice. We need to create our own cultural institutions. Our own Hollywood, our own publishing industry, our own media, our own storytelling industry, and perhaps most importantly, we need to retake our schools. That is an institution that we cannot create on our own, and it has become a factory for creating radicals. It won't be easy because wokeness is so deeply embedded in academia, but we need to retake the schools and use every legal tool available to purge wokeness from the system. We must make the risk of promoting wokeness so enormous that the worst offenders recede to the fringes where they belong. To eliminate this repackaged Marxism known as wokeness, we must take the long march through the institutions.
The good news is that we know what we have to do. We just need to do the work. Take an action to help build our own institutions, to retake our schools. Take an action to help us build a red-pilled America. Because if we don't, and if this series doesn't propel you to act, then we deserve to live in the world that the Marxists have built.
Desmond, you're one of the youngest and first drag queen slash kids.
Not all boys have a penis and not all girls have a vagina.
California Reparations Task Force is making history with a major decision on who will receive compensation.
And even this idea that like, we can't talk about sex with kids. It's like, first of all, we probably can.
My dad says you can't just say that your baby is gay before he gets a chance to tell us he's gay.
Destroying property which can be replaced is not violence.
As a three-parent family, like LGBTQ people.
Can you provide a definition for the word woman?
I can't.
You can't?
Not in this context. So I'm not a biologist.
Red Pilled America is an iHeartRadio original podcast. It's produced by me, Adriana Cortez, and Patrick Carelci for Informed Ventures. Thanks for listening.